it up by having an overview of the path, what the implications of the fact that this is a path of practice, what the Buddha meant by saying that it was noble and it was a middle way. And we talked about the relationships among the various factors and then started with a discussion of right view and right resolve. Do we have any questions left over from yesterday? Anything that came up to you last night? Yes.
Anathapindika and the wanderers. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I understand the first part of what he said, mm-hmm. but let me just refer to it actually in the text. Whatever has been brought into being is fabricated, willed, dependently arisen. That is inconstant. Whatever is inconstant is stressful. I think I've got that. Mm-hmm. The next part, I really don't understand what he means. Mm-hmm. Whatever is stressful is not me, is not what I am, is not myself.
Okay, again, the question is it worth holding on to something that is stressful?
So is he just saying he's not owning it?
He's not owning it.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Over here.
Good morning, Ajahn. I've really appreciated the clarification around what it means to actually be generous and to wish someone goodwill. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if there's anything particular or exceptional for one's parents.
Well, you do have a debt of gratitude to your parents. As I said, they didn't put you out in the trash heap. They raised you. And a lot of us seem to think, well, parents have all their failings. Well, parents have always had failings. But the fact that you're alive today, you owe a lot to them. And so those are the only people the Buddha says you really are indebted to, kind of automatically. Do you have any particular questions along those lines?
So, how to ask this question? So, would my or someone's expression of generosity be different? Would the things I consider around what it means to be generous change mm-hmm. if mm-hmm. I was thinking about my parents?
Well, in their case, there's a sense of, they've, as they get older and get more dependent on you, you want to be able to help them when they need you. And this comes less under generosity and more under gratitude. Generosity tends to be more an issue, as I said, of freely giving freely what you want to give, where you want to give it. But he's got an obligation to help. Now, I know some parents in Asia who tend to abuse that obligation by saying, my children have to do whatever I tell them to do. And that's not what the Buddha was saying. You help them when they need the help. And the best way to help them is, he said, if they're stingy, teach them to be generous. If they're unprincipled, teach them to be principled. And the hardest people in the world to teach are your parents, of course. But set a good example for them. Maybe we'll get through to them. That student I was telling you about, the one who was the cook, his father was a butcher. And he was not happy that his son was going to become a monk. It was basically, he became a monk against, not with their wholehearted support, let's put it that way. But, as I said before, ordained, he got a fund of money so his father could stop killing the pigs. Didn't have to be a butcher anymore. And then when he came back to Singapore, he became a famous Dharma teacher. Now the father's a meditator. And he would sit in the front row and turn around and said, my son. So it is possible. Okay.
As sort of a continuation of that question regarding parents, my parents have passed now. Mm-hmm. Is there anything that I can do in the way of metta practice or whatnot that I
dedicating could dedicating merit.
Dedicating merit?
Of your generosity, your virtue, your meditation.
Okay.
Dedicate it to them.
Okay. Thank you.
Someone once came to the Buddha one time and asked him, you know, I'm making merit for my parents, and this was a Brahmin. Do they receive it? And the Buddha says, if they're in a position to receive it, yes, they will. And of course, the next question is, well, who's in a position to receive it? You're saying automatically hungry ghosts. What you didn't also say was if there are those who happen to know about it and send thoughts of appreciation for your dedication of merit, they receive merit as well. Because that's what it is seeing that someone else is doing something good and rejoicing in their merit. That's how that becomes an act of merit on their part. That's how merit gets transferred. And then the man said, well, what if my parents are not, or my relatives are not hungry ghosts? And the Buddha says, don't worry, everybody has relatives who are hungry ghosts. So some place in your lineage. So do it for them. Yes.
Yesterday, you talked about unskillful states of mind and avoiding the pleasures that bring on unskillful states of mind. How would one become more aware of when you're entering into something like, I don't know, watching too much TV or not being present so that that brings on an unskillful state of mind?
Okay, well, just make it as an experiment. Stop doing whatever that is and see which part of your mind it complains. And then ask yourself, do I want to associate with this particular voice in my mind?
I think I understand.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you, Ajahn. So my mother has an expectation I spend all day, every day with her. She's 92, and she's very unhappy, very resentful. And if I'm with her 2 hours, she complains nonstop to me. Mm-hmm. And so that gets me down. I feel it doesn't help my practice. And also the Buddha said you don't have to hang around with fools. So I don't know, like, I have the guilt, but I know it's not good for me, and it could be, like, at least another 10 years as I get older, and it takes away from my practice, I feel.
Okay, I'd say, you know, an hour a day is quite a lot already, even though she doesn't think it's enough. Again, it's not there to satisfy her idea of what she needs, but you would have to look objectively. What does she really need in this situation? Does she need a listening board all day long if it's all going to be complaints? So maybe an hour a day, cut it down a little bit, and just say, okay, she sat with me when I was a kid and all those other things, so I can give her a little bit of time. And this is also good exercise in learning how to be with someone and learn now how not to pick up that person's mood. So as we're talking about the noises going through the other day, we'll think of her mood just going through and not leaving anything, any residue inside you. There's a question down here.
Ajahn, yesterday you talked about two levels of right resolve.
Mm-hmm.
And wondered if you could talk about what differentiates those two levels. And the one level, it seemed that would take you right to the first
jhana.
Stage of jhana.
Because what you're doing, you're starting out with the resolve not to think thoughts of sensuality, ill will, or harmfulness. And that really segues very easily into, if you say, okay, if I just settle, once I put those thoughts out of my mind, it's very much easier for the mind to settle down. In this case, your resolve is not to get to a place where you're still, when the mind is still with the with the breath, no thoughts of sensuality, no thoughts of ill will, etc. So it's basically kind of a delivering the mind to that spot after having controlled what kind of thinking that you're going to follow and what kind of thinking you're not going to follow. It gets a lot easier for the mind to settle down. As you're settling down, you're still contemplating, how can I get the mind more still? So there's still an element of resolve in there. You're still talking to yourself about that. But it's all pretty much kind of, it's kind of on a continuum.
Okay. It's not like something very different.
But what it's different about is when you actually enter into the first jhana, you say, oh, this is a much stiller state than it was in before. But the mundane level of right resolve, you're kind of laying the groundwork. Because it is, I mean, the word jhana in Pali is actually a neutral term. It can be also used for being really obsessed about anger, but really absorbed in anger, really absorbed in desire. And when the Buddha is saying when right concentration is devoid of sensuality, devoid of unskillful mental qualities, it's the kind of absorption that is not fixated on things.
Yes, I wanted to ask about the stress associated with the three characteristics. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So things are inconstant, mm-hmm. and by virtue of that, there's stress. Mm-hmm. Does it make sense to say that there is stress, but only if you cling?
There's stress for you only if you cling. I mean, it's like, you know, like anything that's put together with from conditions. It depends on those conditions being in a particular state. So the object itself is not experiencing stress, right? Like the bridge is not experiencing stress, but even though there's stress there on the bridge. But there is, just as kind of an objective fact, anything that's dependent on conditions is in a state of precariousness. And that precarious state is kind of the stress of the object. Now, when you have clinging to it, you're suffering from it, and that's when you really feel, that's when you have the suffering of the Four Noble Truths. Thank you.
Ajahn, can you speak a little bit more about the use of the term stress? I'm more familiar with the use of the term suffering.
Suffering, yeah.
Yeah.
I've chosen stress for three reasons. One has to do with a journalist I knew in Bangkok. He was complaining one time. He said, why is Buddhism talking about suffering all the time? I don't have any suffering in my life. I said, do you have any stress? Oh, yeah, lots of stress. I said, that's what we're talking about. One. Two, when you get the mind into very subtle layers of concentration, it's hard to say that there's any suffering there, but as you get more and more sensitive, you realize there is a element of stress in the concentration. And when you think of dukkha as stress, it helps you focus in on, okay, where is the slightest stressfulness in that state? The third reason is it's really hard to romanticize stress. I mean, there are no songs or no novels.
So there's a semantic element.
There's a semantic element there, yeah, yeah.
Thank you.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's move on to the next two factors, which are right speech and right action. Starting with right speech and going on to the remainder of the factors, the distinction between mundane and transcendent elements of the path is really almost, is very nil. So we can talk about both together. Right speech is abstaining from lying, from divisive speech, from harsh speech, and from idle chatter. Right action is abstaining from killing, from stealing, and sexual misconduct. And because of reading here, we'll go into that in a minute. Of these, in terms of the three forms of right action, there are actually precepts that go with those. In other words, when something is a precept, you something try to avoid across the board. You try to totally avoid killing, stealing, sexual misconduct. Among the four forms of right speech, only one is connected with a precept, and that's the one against lying. I was just saying yesterday, I touched on it briefly. With divisive speech, there are actually times when you see that someone is coming in the orbit of someone else and you're afraid of what that other person is going to do to the first person. So if you feel that this is really in that person's best interest, it's okay to warn the person. So technically speaking, that might be divisive speech, but there's a case where it is actually skillful. And then secondly, with harsh speech, you probably know with your own children, if you say, don't do that, sometimes it doesn't work. Say, hey, you, stop, you know. And some people require harsher speech than others. And so the Buddha said, and this is written into the code for the monks, that if someone responds to harsh speech, you have to use harsh speech. A while back I was reading, as I said, when I was preparing the book on the path, I was looking at other people's books on the Eightfold Path, came across a strange idea, which is that if you say something that someone doesn't like, it's harming them. And there is that element in our culture, to some extent, that says, you know, you're harming people, especially it starts with little children. You speak to them in harsh voices, it's harming them. But then people, as they grow up, they tend to expect that you say something I don't like, it's actually harmful. And the Buddha doesn't say that at all. I mean, harmful speech is when you're actually trying to get someone to do something unskillful, or you're doing it with the purpose of you want them to develop greed or aversion and delusion. You're trying to excite those qualities in their minds. And again, as I said yesterday, with idle chatter, there's no way anybody could come out with a precept against that. And so this way you have to ask yourself, when I'm speaking, do I have a clear notion of what my intention is or what I want to accomplish through this speech? If you don't have a clear notion of the intention, that would be idle chatter. John Lee has an interesting addition to that. He says, if you're talking to people who don't understand high level of Dharma and you're showing off your knowledge of high level Dharma, that's idle chatter as well. So, my teacher John Fuang was very careful about that. There was a layperson one time who took upon himself to kind of go around and test the different Ajahns as to what their level of attainment was by asking fairly high level questions about them. And came to John Fuang, and John Fuang says, have you reached this level in your own practice yet? And the guy said, no. And John Fuang said, in that case, I don't want to talk to you about it because it would be idle chatter. The guy left. We talked about yesterday how right view informs these different factors of the path. And in terms of the lessons from right view that come to right speech and right action is understanding what it means in terms of karma to harm yourself and what it means to harm others. In other words, by breaking the precepts, you are harming yourself, or by engaging in wrong speech, wrong action, you're harming yourself. If you're trying to get other people to do those things, then it's harmful for them. Says, you know, working for your benefit or you're working for other people's harm, either you're trying to excite greed, aversion, and delusion in them, or you're trying to get them to break the precepts. That would be harming them. Whereas, and again, we're talking in terms of long-term karmic consequences that would come from respecting the fact that, you know, they are agents and they're actually going to be harmed more by their own actions than by anything you might do to them. And so you have to be careful about what you're trying to induce other people to do. That's where you have to be careful about not harming them. The Buddha talks about how when someone becomes a stream enterer, their virtue becomes pure and their virtue becomes what they say in the terms of the text, pleasing to the noble ones. And it's not simply that you really stick to the precepts, but also that you do not fashion yourself around the precepts, which means that you don't exalt yourself, disparage others about the fact that you have the precepts and they don't have the precepts. At that point, the basic principle. You've seen that there is, the Buddha spoke truly, that there really is a deathless dimension that can be touched in the mind. And you realize the reason you hadn't touched it prior to that was because of your own unskillful actions. And so you're going to be much more scrupulous in the future about what you do and say and think, and particularly your intentions around that. Also realizing that the precepts are there not to bang other people over the head with, but to basically look at your own actions, look at your own intentions, and see very carefully what's going on. And the same way, as you practice right speech and practice right action, you actually give some training back to right view itself in terms of the categories that don't allow for exceptions. In other words, the ones that correspond to precepts, when they're taken as absolute, you have to use your extra discernment, you have to exercise your discernment as to how can I keep to the precept and cause the minimum amount of damage. Because there are times when you have to, when someone asks you a question, and you know if you divulge the information to that person or you suspect that they will misuse the information, how do you withhold it? And the etiquette in Thailand is very different. You can ask a question of someone in Thailand and they just look at you and not answer. That's considered okay. Whereas in the West, if someone did that, the fact that you're answering the question, you have the right to an answer. That's our attitude, which makes it a little bit more difficult here. And so you need to have some skill in learning how to change the subject or answer the question in a way that it's, you're not saying anything technically untrue, but you're not divulging all the information. As for the categories that do allow for exceptions, as in the case of, say, divisive speech or harmful speech or idle chatter, you have to know when you trust your reasoning as to why you're letting yourself engage in that kind of speech. You have to be very careful. Okay, am I honestly avoiding damage here? Or am I actually doing something skillful, say, in warning one person about another person? Or is there some unskillful motivation involved? So this is forcing you to look more carefully at your motivation and your reasoning for why you're engaging in certain kinds of speech. At the same time, exercising right speech and right action gives exercising qualities that are needed for mindfulness. You have to be more alert. One, start, you have to be mindful to keep the precept in mind. Two, you have to be more alert to what you're actually doing. And then three, it develops the ardency to learn how to say, okay, there's certain habits that I have that are against the precepts. I've got to work on those to bring them more in line with the precepts. I'll give you an example. One of my teacher's students from Bangkok came out to the monastery one time and she noticed that everybody else was taking the 8 precepts, so she took the 8 precepts too. And then one afternoon she was walking past a guava tree and the guavas looked really nice. And before she knew it, the guava was in her mouth. And John Fuang happened to be nearby and he said, "Hey, what's in your mouth?" And she realized that she'd had lacked a lot of alertness. And also in training the mind, there are three questions that the Buddha says if you're going to engage in speech that you should ask yourself before you say something. The first thing is, one, is it true? Two, is it beneficial? Because there are certain things may be true, but they're not going to be of any benefit, so don't engage in them. Then the second question is, okay, is it beneficial? And then the third question, is this the right time to say something pleasing or the right time to say something unpleasing? So in other words, having a sense of right time and place. So true, beneficial, in line, right in time of place. And learn to ask those questions of your speech. You find ultimately the same questions can be applied to thoughts that come up in the course of your meditation. When you start getting obsessed with something, is this true? Is this beneficial to be thinking about? And is this the right time and place to be thinking about it? So in these ways, the practice of right speech and right action give you some preparation for the meditation. And also, you need virtue to allow for your concentration to yield the fruit of genuine discernment based on honesty. Because practicing the precepts gives you lack of remorse. You don't have to need to deny things that you've done in the past. Because what happens usually when you start settling down and there is something that you've done where you've harmed somebody recently, that'll come up immediately in your mind. And either you're going to get tied up in remorse or else you're going to get into denial. And neither is conducive to getting the mind to settle down where it can have discernment and we look at itself clearly. So it's best to avoid the kinds of actions that would lead to that kind of remorse. And finally, this practice of what's called non-fashioning, i.e. not creating a sense of self around the practice of the precepts, is also useful in the practice of concentration. Again, you're not practicing concentration to beat out other people's concentration. There was a problem among my teacher students in Bangkok. I think I mentioned to you that when John Fung taught, he would sit with a group of people sitting around him, and he seemed to sense when things were happening in people's meditation. And he would actually call on you. He's saying, Brock, something, what's going on in your meditation right now? And Brock said, just I had a vision of something. Okay. Then he said, this is what you do. And of course, everybody else was all ears about Brock's, you know, Brock's level. And he said, okay, now you let go of the breath and you do this and this. And people began to get a sense of who was more advanced in concentration than the others. And on the one hand, it actually got people, you know, more serious about the meditation. But secondly, there was that sense of competition, which is not all that skillful. And so if you learn that you're practicing the precepts not for the sake of exalting yourself, but simply because you need them, then when you get to the concentration, it's the same sort of thing. You're not going to be comparing your jhana to other people's jhana. So those are some of the lessons that come from the practice of right speech and right action. Let's look at the passages. Passage number 15. You notice here when the Buddha is talking about virtue, how you're made pure through verbal action, it's not just by avoiding unskillful kinds of speech and action, but also by cultivating more their positive counterparts. Okay, start with the speech. There's a case where a certain person abandoning false speech abstains from false speech. When he's been called to a town meeting, a group meeting, a gathering of his relatives, his guild, or of the royalty, in other words, he has to go to court. If he's asked as a witness, come and tell a good man what you know. If he doesn't know, he says, I don't know. If he does know, he says, I know. If he hasn't seen, he says, I haven't seen. If he has seen, he says, I have seen. Thus he doesn't consciously tell a lie for his own sake, for the sake of another, or for the sake of any reward. Abandoning false speech, he abstains from false speech. He speaks the truth, holds to the truth, is firm, reliable, no deceiver of the world. Okay, so you become reliable in your speech by abandoning what is false. Secondly, abandoning divisive speech, you abstain from divisive speech. What you have heard here, you do not tell there to break those people apart from these people here. What you've heard there, you do not tell here to break these people apart from those people there. Thus, reconciling those who have broken apart, or cementing those who are united. You love concord, delight in concord, enjoy concord, speaks things that create concord. Third one, abandoning abusive speech, you abstain from abusive speech. You speak words that are soothing to the ear, that are affectionate, that go to the heart, that are polite, appealing, and pleasing to people at large. Abandoning idle chatter, you abstain from idle chatter. You speak in season, what is factual, what is in accordance with the goal, the Dharma, and the Vinaya. You speak words worth treasuring, seasonable, reasonable, circumscribed, connected with the goal. Circumscribed means that you are very careful about how you state things. This is how one is made pure in four ways, by verbal action. Is there anything there that requires any explanation? Yes.
I just noticed, I mean, this is a general description for everyone, and it mentions speaking in accordance with the Vinaya. So mm-hmm. Does that imply that the restrictions on speech in the Vinaya should be taken to heart by lay people?
Well, the restrictions on speech in the Vinaya are, one, you do not make false claims about your attainments. In other words, you don't lie about those. Two, you don't insult people. And three, you don't speak divisively. That's basically what the Vinaya requires. So things that monks are not allowed to ask for, that doesn't apply to lay people. But the other things about that actually no false speech, no divisive speech, no harsh speech, no insults. There's a great long list of insults in the Pali Canon. One of the insults is there are goats among us. And of course, that's the example that the Buddha gave when calling Devadatta a lick spittle. That's an example of harsh speech that he felt was required by the circumstances. But that would be it's a great insult. It's one of those great Shakespearean insults that have kind of died away. So we try to avoid those.
Okay, I think I was thinking of that long list. I was remembering that there was a lot of restrictions, but it was probably just that.
It was just that. I mean, you don't... It's. I think one of the reasons why they put those in there is that when the monks got to chant them, they got to say the insults, even though it was fun.
And attainments, is it only false claims? I thought it was any claim about attainments.
Okay, monks are not allowed to make their talk about their actual attainments to lay people. They can talk to other monks about it, but they're not to lay people.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, we go on to right action. Now, years back, I think I was doing a little discussion of the precepts, and when I was in Massachusetts, it always comes up, somebody asks a question about, what do you do in this situation, what do you do in that situation, it kind of ends the discussion. One in Massachusetts was, can you lie in your tax returns? In fact, I just got a phone call from someone recently saying it's. I think lying to people and lying to governments is a very different thing. I kept saying, "Well, people, governments are people. No, but they're bureaucrats, but they're people. Come on." And then a couple weeks after that, I was in Laguna Beach in California, and we're going over the precepts and. Like the issue that came up is that your friend is wearing an ugly dress and she asks, how do I look and what do you say? And I said, that's up to you. But you can think, okay, you look better dressed than you would look undressed. So yes, it looks fine. You don't have to tell the entire reasoning that leads up to this conclusion, but yes, you look fine. Okay, how is one made pure by three ways by bodily action? That's the case for a certain person abandoning the taking of life, abstains from the taking of life. You dwell with your rod laid down, your knife laid down, scrupulous, merciful, compassionate for the welfare of all living beings. In other words, no killing of pests. And what this means is you have to learn, okay, what is it that keeps the pests out then without killing them? Ants are relatively easy. They're things they don't like to walk over. Apparently walking over talc hurts their feet. So just lay down a lay of talc. Other ants don't seem to mind the talc, but if you have, do they have St. Luke's powder here in Canada? St. Luke's powder, it's kind of a talcum powder that has a menthol added to it. Ants really dislike that. They also dislike kerosene, they dislike grease. So, Vaseline. So if you find out this is where the ants are coming in, you just lay down a little track of Vaseline around it, and they won't cross over it. Okay. Abandoning the taking of what is not given, you abstain from taking what is not given. You do not take in the manner of a thief things in a village or a wilderness that belong to others that have not been given. So in other words, you know the object has an owner, and the owner would not be pleased by your taking it, you don't take it. Abandoning sexual misconduct, you abstain from sexual misconduct. You do not get sexually involved with those who are protected by their mothers, their fathers, their brothers, their sisters, their relatives. Okay, those are minors. Those who are protected by their dharma, those who have taken a vow of celibacy, those with husbands or wives, those who entail punishments, in other words, the concubines of a king, or even those crowned with flowers by another man, in other words, people going steady. You don't move in. This is how one is made pure in three ways by bodily action. Okay, any questions about any of those? Okay, this brings us to the topic of right livelihood. Now, as I noted yesterday, the definition of right livelihood is not all that helpful. Just basically says abandoning dishonest livelihood, you make your living by right livelihood. We will get to that, though, in a minute, a passage where the Buddha talks about the five occupations that should be avoided. Also, he said, the principle that comes through some of his discussions is that you should avoid occupations that entail giving rise to anger in yourself or give rise to greed, aversion, and delusion in others. The two main instances that come up in the canon are, on the one hand, professional soldiering. There was a case where, you know, a soldier comes and says, our soldier teachers taught us that if you die in battle, you go to the heaven of heroes. And the Buddha, and again, the Buddha says, don't ask me that. And so the man insists, and so finally, after the third request, the Buddha says, if, you know, while you're in battle, you're thinking, may these beings come to destruction, may these beings be destroyed, may these beings, you know, be harmed. That state of mind, if you die with that state of mind, then you're going to go to a lower realm. And if you believe that you're going to go to heaven through that, it's wrong view. And wrong view also takes you to a lower realm. So the soldier breaks down and cries, and the Buddha said, this is why I told you not to ask the question. And the soldier said, no, I'm not crying for your answer. I'm crying because I've been deceived for so long by my teachers. So you try to avoid an occupation that involves giving rise to anger in yourself. And yesterday we talked about the case of acting. I think advertising falls under there as well, giving rise to greed, aversion, and delusion in others. Also, you should avoid dishonest ways of following occupations that otherwise might be right. There's a passage where Sariputta finds out that one of his former students has changed his attitude. His good wife died, and then a very bad wife took over and started pushing him for a lot of money. And so he started, as I said, cheating the king in the name of the people, cheating the people in the name of the king. In other words, he was a tax collector. And in the name of the king, he asked for more money from the people than he should have taken. And then in the name of the people, saying, well, the people didn't pay all that much. And so he gives the king only a little bit. So he's taking a huge cut out of the taxes. And so Sariputta hears about this. He says, gee, I hope I have a chance to meet with him someday. So he does. And he asks them, and when he meets them, he asks them, how's your practice going? And the man says, what practice? I don't have any time for practice. I've got to look after my family. And Sariputta says, if when you die, the hell guardians come and take you for cheating the king, and you say, well, I had to do it for my family, so please excuse me. Will the hell guardians listen to you, or will they throw you into hell while you're asking for their mercy? And so, well, they throw them into hell while I'm asking for mercy. And he goes on to say, there are other ways of making a living that don't involve being dishonest, and you're going to harm yourself if you're making a living in a harmful way. Yesterday I mentioned some New Yorker cartoons, and there's this one where these two members of the gang in New York are carrying this guy who's obviously dead, with his feet already in cement, carry him down the wharf, and one of them says, I wish there were another way to make a living. And as you make your choice about what kind of livelihood you're going to follow, you may realize that making a right livelihood may involve having to do with less. Because there are a lot of forms of wrong livelihood that pay very well. But you follow a right livelihood and you have to content yourself with less. And so this is one of the reasons why the Buddha has you develop contentment. For the monks, this means reflecting on your requisites every day, that you eat only what is needed to keep the body going. You use only what clothing and shelter is needed for your protection. You use only enough medicine to get rid of disease. You're not going to be bulking up or anything. Contentment for lay people means having initiative in making your living, guarding your gains, and making good use of your wealth. The Buddha does not criticize people who have a lot of initiative in making money, as long as it's done with honest means. And then once you've gained your property, then you look after it very carefully. And then making good use of your wealth is for the sake of your own happiness, in this life, the sake of your family's happiness, as a gift to society, and then as a sort of an investment in your future happiness, in being generous. So these are some of the things that you have to think about when you're thinking about right livelihood. There are times when you have to take a job that pays less than other people might be making, but you say, well, I don't need those things. I can get along perfectly well without them. And my family will be happier in the long run. The discernment that gains from this is, again, lack of remorse or denial, and also insight into this whole necessity for feeding. The fact that, you know, we're born into this world with a mouth that never seems to get full. It makes you wonder, you know, maybe it would be better if I didn't have to feed. Because all the difficulties that go in with making a living in an honest way, you realize it would much be easier if I could take this mouth out of the equation. So it gets you more inclined to see that the ability to have a happiness that doesn't require feeding would be a good thing. So those are some of the lessons from Right Livelihood. The one passage we have on Right Livelihood is on number 17. Monks, a lay follower should not engage in five types of business. Which five? Business and weapons, business and living beings. That means buying and selling cattle, buying and selling human slaves. Business in meat, business in intoxicants, and business in poisons. So those are to be avoided. Any particular questions on Right Livelihood?
It's kind of interesting that on right action, for precept-wise, the refraining from intoxicants is conspicuously absent.
Yeah. And why, I really don't know. I can't tell you. I mean, it's very definitely listed as one of the five precepts in the canon itself. But from reason, when it gets to the path, it's not mentioned. I don't know why.
It's never mentioned, or is it just this?
It's mentioned in the precepts. It's not mentioned in the
right action.
When he's discussing the Eightfold Path, unless it's kind of implicit in the practice of mindfulness.
Yeah.
It's hard to be mindful when you're drinking.
Reading the five listening to you talk about the five occupations that should be avoided, it seems to me it's all about the intent behind the occupation and the result of the occupation.
Right.
My desire actually is to be a farmer that raises compassionate meats.
Now, these are meats that are compassionate to the people who eat them, or
so for me, it's been a long journey to get here, but I don't feel any ill will, because I'm going to restore the land using cattle. So, and the cattle is not going to be, you know, mistreated. Could you speak to that? I'm not sure what I'm asking, but anyway.
The problem with this is that if you're making your livelihood off of somebody else's suffering, you tend to turn a blind eye to the point where they're suffering. That the cattle are not mistreated up to a point. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So. Question back there.
Ajahn, thank you. I work as an academic at one of the medical schools up north, and I'm on one of the animal care committees for the ethics around research with animals, and a lot of my colleagues make a living doing research with animals, and I'm wondering if you could comment on that. Many of the projects are approved from the research boards, but from a Buddhist perspective, I think being on that committee, I often pose questions which I think help people think about things, but I don't feel in some ways that I can say, okay, you can't do your livelihood.
Mm-hmm. Again, the Buddha never went around saying, you know, you can't do this livelihood. Yeah. But I was just pointing out to people, hey, you make your living in this way. Think about the suffering you're inflicting. And there was one case where a monk went to an executioner one time, and he says, you know, don't kill your victims, don't torture your victims before you kill them, just kill them cleanly. And the Buddha threw him out. You don't tell them how to kill, because that's the same as killing, or giving the order to kill. So you might say, okay, just think about everything you can, don't inflict any unnecessary suffering on the animals. I mean, I can see that perhaps as your role in there, but because there are a lot of unnecessary suffering even for animals in research. Did you ever see the cartoon Bloom County? They had that whole sequence on Mary Kay Cosmetics and the animal testing. It was pretty brutal. I mean. The best one was, of course, the supposed Mary Kay response to the animal testing that Bloom County was doing, and showing off their cartoons to little rabbits. And they were really bad, the rabbits would be stunned, you know. The mic's not on.
Okay. Thank you. And maybe following up on the question from the well-intentioned meat farmer, I have a story that I like eating meat, and I do eat meat.
Mm-hmm.
And I prefer certainly to buy it from farmers or from a source where I believe the animal has been treated respectfully up until the point that the trigger's been pulled or what. Now, in terms of right action or these precepts, is it really, like, from the Buddha perspective, not okay to eat meat?
No. He said the precept only covers when you do something yourself, or you give the direct order for it to be done.
Okay.
Like for monks, we're allowed, if something has not been killed specifically for our purpose, for the purpose of feeding monks, then it's okay for us to eat it. The Buddha himself apparently ate meat. So
what about the actual farmer then?
Okay, the fact that the farmer was treating the animals nicely, Is the farmer's good karma? The fact that he was getting them killed, that becomes bad karma. So it's a mixture. At the very least, we're not doing what they used. Apparently, I was reading a recipe from the 18th century. There was this belief that animals tasted best if they were in a state of severe fright before they died. And so the recipes for, say, you know, roast chicken, in which you first have to chase the chicken around the kitchen. So at least we've stopped doing that. Yeah.
Okay, just to belabor it a little bit more, it seems there's a contradiction then. If it's okay for me to
be on that,
eat meat, yet my father or my sister is the one who's killing it for my benefit.
Mm-hmm. And this is the point where the Buddha says, you know, wouldn't it be better if we got into a state where the mind doesn't need to feed? Because when you get down to it, every form of feeding is going to involve suffering for somebody. Even if you're eating a vegetarian meal, they have to kill the pests, they have to kill and so there's no absolute pure way of eating in the world. So this, you take this, and this is a good incentive to Sangwega. To realize it would be better if I could find a way of being that doesn't require eating at all. Because the Buddha's not saying that you're going to become perfectly pure in the way you eat, but you get closer to purity by not giving the order for things to die or not killing them yourself. But there still is this element that, and we're, as the monks are supposed to reflect on this every day, that the fact that you need food, clothing, shelter, and medicine means that it's imposing suffering on somebody someplace. If it's not killing somebody, then the difficulty that people have in having to make a living, say, as working on construction or working on in factories and those kinds of things, there's going to be suffering. And this is an inherent part of being a human being, that we're not in here as totally independent beings, but there's a network of, and everyone talks about interconnectedness being really wonderful and everybody benefits from it, and well, no, and a lot of people getting oppressed. I mean, even something as simple as the weather system. You know, you're having this drought up here. We're having wonderful weather down in San Diego. And it's all interconnected. So interconnectedness is not a good thing, that it's kind of inner being is inter-eating. And so the question is, how do you eat in such a way that you get to the point where you don't need to feed anymore? And part of it is trying to hold to the precepts as a certain measured way of putting a minimum amount of oppression on others, but realizing that there will never be a totally oppressive, less system of feeding. I mean, Kurt Vonnegut imagined the planet Mercury. Did you ever read The Sirens of Titan? You did, yeah. And he's got Mercury as this honeycomb crystal with one face sighting the sun and the other face is out to space. And because there's the tension between the heat on the one side and the cold on the other side, the crystal is always singing. And these little animals called harmoniums. They look like little kites with suction cups on the corners. And all they have to do is just go hook into a nice spot of the crystal where the vibration is really nice. And that's their food. So that's a world where nobody has to feed on anybody else. But it doesn't exist. And they send two messages to each other. Here I am, here I am, here I am. The other is, so glad you are, so glad you are, so glad you are. In a world where there's no feeding on one another, those are the messages we would have for one another all the time. But given the fact of feeding, there's suffering for us, suffering for other people. So we have to take that into consideration. Yes, back here.
So now I'm kind of unclear about what to think about vegetarianism from a Buddhist perspective, based on what was just said. So I did know before that it's okay for monks to eat meat if it wasn't directly prepared for them, right? But what about from a layperson's perspective? Is ordering meat at a restaurant unethical if you're creating demand for animals to be killed?
As a precept, it's not against the precept, but you might decide, I really don't want to get involved in that chain. That's a personal choice.
Sort of a comment, perhaps, on that. I watched a movie recently, which is very rare for me, a documentary. And it was an architect, and he said, you know, the most responsible thing we can do is live in the smallest possible space that we can. Mm-hmm. And I thought, you know, that's a very, I think that's kind of a little bit what we're talking about, because my sense is that it's, this is the middle way. Mm-hmm. It's not an absolute way. Mm-hmm. Sort of a comment.
Yeah. Well, that's, you know, again, that's up to the individual, how small. Yeah,
exactly.
Before the family starts exploding.
Yes. Well, we have some differences of opinion on yes. that. Views and opinions subject to change.
Yes. Okay, right effort. We went through the definition of right effort the other day, which is generating desire, arousing persistence, and upholding your intent for the non-arising of unskillful qualities that have not yet arisen, for the abandoning of unskillful qualities that have arisen, for the arising of skillful qualities that have not yet arisen, and for the culmination of the skillful qualities that have arisen. When we talk about right effort, I also touched yesterday on the four roles that discernment plays in determining that we're not just engaging in brute effort, we're engaging in right effort. And first you have the distinction between skillful and unskillful qualities in the mind. What is skillful? Anything that would be harmful, that would lead to suffering for yourself or for other people, that would be unskillful. Skillful is what avoids that harm. There are the three roots of unskillful behavior, which are passion, aversion, and delusion, or greed, aversion, and delusion. There is the issue in right effort of learning how to use unskillful qualities in a skillful way. In other words, you've got one unskillful quality, use another unskillful quality to counteract it sometimes. We gave the example of craving being used, conceit being used. There's a passage where the Buddha is talking about ways of overcoming anger. And basically says, you know, if I act on this anger of mine, I will tend to do something really stupid. I look ugly when I'm giving vent to my anger. I tend to destroy my own wealth. I tend to misperceive what is to my advantage and what is to my disadvantage. All of these things will give pleasure to my enemy. Do I want to please my enemy? So out of spite, you overcome your anger. So that's the use of an unskillful quality to counteract another unskillful quality. So that's the first use of discernment in right effort, is understanding the difference between skillful and unskillful, and actually have a pragmatic sense of how to use unskillful qualities. And John Lee talks about when he was a young monk, he would get into meditation contests with his other monks. You know, they'd say, okay, I'll sit while you walk, and you sit while I walk, and vice versa. And so he was getting late in the night, and he was getting really tired, and all of a sudden he heard this bang from inside the little hut where the monk was sitting. He looked inside. The monk was still in full lotus position, but he'd fallen back, fallen asleep. And he said, I won. And so, of course, later on he had to deal with that pride, but at least the pride is what kept him going. I have my own version of that story. When I was first ordained, there was a young Thai guy who was ordained about the same time I was. And so we'd go up to the top of the hill where there was this little wooden shack, well, actually a fairly large wooden shack, and sit and meditate. And I'd be sitting there, and my legs would be in pain, and the mosquitoes would be biting, and I'd be wanting to get up and leave. But I looked over at him, and he was looking very calm. And I said, okay, I can't. To maintain the good name of Americans, I've got to. I can't give in. So I'd sit there further. And then I found out later he was sitting there in pain with the mosquitoes and looking over at me and said, oh, this American, I can't lose to this American. So using unskillful qualities to develop skillful ones. Okay, the second issue is this one of motivation when he's talking about generating desire. We touched on these yesterday. Let's go over them again. Use heedfulness. The Buddha said this is your basic motivation for being skillful in all situations, is the realization that if I don't act in a skillful way, there's going to be danger down the line, so I better learn how to act in a skillful way. In other words, seeing danger and doing what you can to prevent it. That being one reason to motivate yourself. Another was compassion, compassion for yourself. This passage where the Buddha talks about, he says, using yourself as a governing principle. If you feel like giving up on the path, you remind yourself, I embarked on this path because I was suffering, and I wanted to put an end to suffering. Have I stopped wanting to put an end to suffering? If I do, do I love myself? And that's a way of motivating yourself to stick with it. That out of compassion for yourself, you stick with it. There is a passage where the Buddha said, even if you're practicing and you've gotten to the point where tears are running down your face, the fact that you stick with it is going to be good for you, so you don't give up easily. A sense of shame. This is when the Buddha calls using the world as your governing principle. He says, you're sitting there thinking unskillful thoughts, and you remind yourself, there are people and other beings who can read minds. Do I want them to read these thoughts in my mind? So it uses a sense of shame, which is connected with a sense of pride. When you take joy in the practice, there's that passage where the Buddha is teaching his son, Rahula, that he should look at his actions before, during, and afterwards. And if he's, say, planning to do something, and he asks himself, what results do I anticipate from this? And if you anticipate any harm, you don't do it. If you don't anticipate harm, you go ahead and do it. If while you're doing it, you find that actual harm is being caused, you stop. And if there's no harm being caused, you continue. Then after the action is done, you reflect on the long-term consequences and you realize that, you know, there was unexpected harm that happened. You talk it over with someone else, develop a sense of shame around that activity, and then you don't do it again. However, if you see that there's no harm, you take joy in the fact that, you know, I'm progressing on the path. This is when it's okay to sort of pat yourself a little bit on the back. Remind yourself, okay, this is good, what I'm doing. Because that will then give you the incentive to do this skillful thing the next time around. For example, if you have an addiction, and one night you're successful in not giving in to your addiction, the next morning, reflect on the fact, I'm really glad I didn't give in to my addiction last night. Remember that. So the next time you feel tempted to give in, you remind yourself, okay, tomorrow morning I'm going to feel really good that I didn't give in tonight. And that sense of joy gives you your motivation. And then finally, there's the noble example of others. You read about Ajahn Mun, you read about Ajahn Chah, Ajahn Lee, the other great Ajahns. And you realize, okay, they dealt with difficulties and they were able to come through well. I can take their example. There are cases like this in the canon. There's a monk who's out in the forest and he's sick, and the question is, am I going to go back into town and try to find a doctor, or am I going to stay here and practice? So he says, I can stay here and practice, and I'm thinking of the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha to motivate myself. You know, the fine example of the Buddha putting up with hardship, the members of the Sangha putting up with hardship. These are ways of motivating yourself. The type of effort, that's another issue that comes up with discernment. The Buddha talks about four types of effort in terms of preventing, abandoning, developing, and then bringing to culmination. The preventing is one that tends to get short shrift in a lot of Buddhist discussions. In other words, seeing, I'm going to go into a situation and I know I'm going to be tempted to do something unskillful. And sitting down and thinking it through beforehand, how can I not have my buttons pushed and do stupid things? And this could be actually a good use of your meditation time, is put aside 10 minutes at the end of the meditation and say, okay, I know tomorrow I'm going to be meeting with my boss. My boss is pretty good at pushing my buttons. How do I learn how not to say something? How can I anticipate what he's going to say or she's going to say? And how can I think of ways to respond that are not going to get, or, you know, give rise to more unskillful things? That's actually a good use of your meditation. When I was staying with the John Furung, he was very careful in as to how a topic should be broached. Especially a student coming to a teacher, if I came to him with a problem and it sounded like I was just placing the responsibility on him to solve the problem, he would throw it right back at me. And there would be no discussion that day. And so my evening job was always to go up and clean up his hut. So as I was walking up to the hut, I would kind of rehearse in my mind, you know, if I say it like this, what is he going to say? If I say it like that, what is he going to say? And finally got to ways, okay, how to approach a topic in a way that he would be willing to respond, i.e. showing that I put some thought into it myself and actually tried various ways myself, and then get his advice. And so that way your kind of anticipation is very helpful. And then I found out later on, as I was having to deal with other senior monks in Bangkok and other places, I found it very easy to talk to them and sort of basically get what I wanted out of them without getting yelled at. One thing I learned from him is, if you're going to say no to somebody in a high position, you have to really know how to say no. Which in Thailand, I'm sure that they've got the same problem in business here, but in Thailand there's a very strong sense of hierarchy. When someone in a senior position or a position higher in authority, when they request something, you have to have a really, really good reason to say no. You just can't say no and leave it at that. one of the most famous examples in Thailand is the king of Thailand wanted to build an ordination hall for Ajahn Mahabua. And Ajahn Mahabua said no. And they gave a reason, which was that he said, when I have monks come here and they're not behaving the way I want them to do, I can always send them back to their preceptor. But if they ordain here, I wouldn't have any place to send them. So they came back off. Another example I really liked was Ajahn Sawat. He would go back to Thailand once a year, and it tended to be in the winter, which is the time of the king's birthday, and the king liked to invite forest monks into the palace for his birthday celebration. So one time Ajahn Sawat was invited in, and the king said to him, why are you in America? Why don't you come back here to Thailand? If Westerners want to study the Dharma, they can come here. And Ajahn Sawat had his answer prepared. He said, I'm not there for the Americans, I'm there for the Thais, who don't have anybody to depend on. Even the king had to back off. One time I had to go in and see the Supreme Patriarch for visa signature. And he invited me, I was sitting out in front of his hut, and he invited me in, and we got to talking, and I guess he figured my Thai was good. So I said, could you translate some of my books for me? And I told him, I'm not finished with Ajahn Lee yet. This is something I learned from a friend. He said, always have an unfinished project. That you can use as an excuse. And so I pulled that one out and saved myself. So learning how to anticipate difficult situations is actually a useful time of right effort. Use of right effort. So meditation is not always just about being in the present. It's about thinking down the line. If I say this, do this, what are the consequences going to be? If they don't look good, let's back up and try something else. So that's the type of right effort that tends to be ignored. And finally, there's the amount of effort. We talked about this a little bit yesterday. One, depending on your own level of energy. The example of the monk who had been a lute player before he ordained. And this an issue of the issue itself. I mean, what kind of effort does it require? I mean, there are some unskillful states in your mind, and all you have to do is look at them. You just look at them steadily, and they go away. And the reason they're able to survive and have influence over you is because you're not really looking at them steadily. You're letting them kind of operate back in the back corners of your mind. But there are others where the Buddha says you have to exert a fabrication. Now remember the three kinds of fabrication we talked about. There's breathing, there's bodily fabrication, directed thought and evaluation is verbal fabrication, and then perceptions and feelings are mental fabrication. And so you realize, again, if you have an unskillful state, I've got to exert any one of these three, or perhaps all three of these, against that unskillful state. So we talked about anger. Okay, you learn how to breathe in a way that does not aggravate the anger. You learn how to think in ways that would undercut the anger. And then the images you hold in your mind about what the situation is going about, what's going on, you change those perceptions. The same with lust. You ask yourself, well, what's attractive about lust? And you say, well, this object is really attractive. And they say, well, the Buddha said, really look carefully at it. You can look at this human body in lots of different ways that are not attractive at all. This is where they have the contemplation of the 32 parts of the body. Or of what's going to happen to the body as it gets old and as it dies. As a way of saying, okay, the object isn't really not worth it. Then you turn around and you look at the lust itself. And oftentimes we feel our lust is an attractive state of mind. There's an allure. So you have to say, okay, what do you think you're getting out of this? What perceptions are you holding in mind? And that, if you're feeling that, well, I just really got to get into this, you say, okay, what part of the body is feeling tense right now? Relax that with the breathing. So you learn how to exert any one of these three fabrications against the unskillful state. The discernment that gets gained, okay, those are the four areas where discernment gets applied to right effort. The distinction between what's skillful and unskillful, the motivation, the type of effort, and the amount of effort that has to go into it. The discernment that's gained is you understand cause and effect, and especially in the area of how to get yourself to do things you don't like doing but will give good results, and to talk yourself out of doing things you like doing that will give bad results. There's a passage where the Buddha said there are four kinds of action in the world. Things you like doing that give good results, things you don't like doing give bad results. Those two are no-brainers. You like to do it, gives good results, no problem. You don't like to do it, gives bad results, no problem. The problem is the things you like to do that give bad results and things you don't like to do that give good results. And he said that's going to be the measure of your discernment in very practical terms. In fact, this is kind of the ground level of discernment. You think about Buddhist wisdom, we tend to think about things about emptiness, not self, all these others, and they can get very abstract. But the question is, well, how do these concepts help you get up in the morning on a cold, dark morning in Victoria in the winter, and you've got to meditate, but you say, boy, that bed looks really nice and warm. How is emptiness going to help get you out of bed? Or is how is not self going to get you out of bed? You say, okay, the comfort in the bed is not self. Okay. It is empty of inherent. And then how to talk yourself out of not doing things, talk yourself into not doing things that you like to do. So there's an appeal to doing this, but you think about down the line, there's going to be trouble. And your ability to negotiate those problems, that those are the... That's a test of your real test of your discernment. Any question on any of those issues? Yes.
So it's okay to, I spend a lot of time when I meditate in preparing and thinking about the future and how I can deal with certain situations. Mm-hmm. It shocked me a little bit to hear you say that, actually.
Well, don't give all your time in meditation. Save that for the end. One good way I found is to pose the question in your mind before you meditate. Say, this is an issue I've got to think about. And then drop it. And for a certain duration of time, whenever that issue comes up, say, not yet, not yet, not yet. I've really got to work on my concentration. And then towards the end of the meditation, when you kind of set the timer, okay, now is my time to think. Sometimes the issue will have been resolved. And otherwise, if it hasn't been resolved, then the mind is clearer and it is calmer and in a better position to think about these things. But beware of it, that kind of thinking taking over the whole meditation. Be quite strict with yourself about when you will and will not think about those things.
Can I ask another question?
Sure.
Related to this? I thought I heard you say at one point in time that it's okay to stop meditating if you encounter particularly stubborn, obstinate thoughts that you cannot lay to rest using everything at your disposal. Stop and deal with them. Stop meditating and deal with them.
Okay, well, I wouldn't say stop meditating, but you should make your meditation a dealing with those problems meditation. That is the same sort of thing. So, okay, I'm going to deal with these problems, but on the condition I let myself get quiet first, at least for 5 minutes. So I'll approach them with more clarity. Mm-hmm. There's a question down here.
So along the lines of right effort, yesterday you mentioned recollection of calm.
Mm-hmm.
Can you explain that a little bit? Because I haven't really read anything or heard anything.
There's not much written about it. Partly because the kind of calm that is written about seems to be designed for people who've already had some sort of noble attainment, and you recollect the attainment. But if you haven't had one, you can think about it. It'd be really nice to get my mind calm. There's a lot of virtue in calmness, because there's a passage where the Buddha talks about having respect for the training, And then he backs up again. He says, particularly having respect for concentration. Now, it's already covered under the training, but he emphasizes the fact that people do tend to overlook the value of concentration, the value of a calm mind. I remember myself in Thailand one time, I was getting the mind pretty well centered, and then something up in my mind said, hey, this is dumb, you're not thinking about anything. And I said, okay, I'll be dumb for a while, you know. So I learned how to appreciate the fact that the mind can grow calm. It may not seem to be doing anything for you, just kind of sitting there, but it'll have its rewards later on. And so you remind yourself of the fact that a calm mind really does serve a lot of good purposes.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Question over here.
I might have misheard you, but yesterday the thing about self mm-hmm. came up. Mm-hmm. And I was under the impression that you said the Buddha really said that was a fruitless line of inquiry or something to that effect.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But then, of course, he talks about dependent origination, and you just talk now about the no inherently existent self. So I'm having a bit of a wonder about that.
Okay, the no inherent existence, I was just borrowing a Mahayana concept. The question of does the self exist, does the self not exist, that's the question the Buddha put aside. Now the question is, when you're identifying yourself as part of becoming, what times is it useful and beneficial to identify with something, what times is it not? And ultimately you get to the point where you can let go of any identification, but before then you need to hold on to certain things. You're going to be creating a state of becoming around your concentration, around your virtue, as a means of developing these things. So in that case, when the Buddha talks about, the self should be its own mainstay, that's the kind of self you're developing. You're a sense of self that's responsible, that does have a sense of heedfulness. But you're trying to identify yourself, well, is myself my body, or is myself my feelings? So the Buddha says, no, it's not worth it. Yeah. In psychology, they talk about 5 healthy ego functions. And the Buddha actually recommends all 5. The first one is anticipation, which in Buddhism is heedfulness. You have enough sense of a self to realize, okay, I am going to suffer down the line unless I do this now. That sense of self is going to be useful. The second one is altruism, which in Buddhism is compassion. In other words, seeing that if your happiness depends on other people's suffering, it's not going to last. And that principle is illustrated in the canon in the story of King Basenadi and Queen Malika. They're alone in the palace, upper rooms of the palace, and in a tender moment the king turns to the queen and says, is there anyone you love more than yourself? You know what he's expecting? Yes, your majesty, you know. But Queen Malika is no fool, you know. And this is the Pali Canon anyhow. And he says, no, there's nobody I love more than myself. What about you? You know. And he has to say, you're right, there's nobody I love more than myself. End of scene. He goes down to see the Buddha, reports what happened, and the Buddha says, she's right. You could search the whole world and not find anybody that you love more than yourself. And at the same time, everybody else loves themselves just as fiercely. But the conclusion he draws is not that it's a dog-eat-dog world. His conclusion is, do not harm or get anyone else to harm anyone else. Because if your happiness depends on their suffering, they're not going to stand for it. So this is the beginning of compassion. So that's altruism. It's based on your own self-good and seeing the long term. The next quality is suppression, which in Buddhism would be restraint. Knowing that if I give vent to certain activities, it's going to be bad, so I've got to learn how to say no. That has to go along with sublimation. If I can't find happiness in that way, I've got to have an alternative route of happiness, which in the Buddhist practice would be the practice of right concentration. Finding a sense of well-being inside, so you don't feel the need to have to go out and feed on unskillful behavior. The 5th function is humor, which we talked about already yesterday. Learning to step back from your defilements and be able to laugh at them in a good-natured way. say, oh my gosh, how did I let myself think something so stupid? And then there's the sixth one, which they don't mention in psychology, but which is very much in a sense of self, which is your sense of shame. You know, I would be ashamed to do that, which is a side of, which is, you know, goes along with a sense of high self-esteem. So all of these are healthy ego functions, and they're all recommended as part of the path. They involve a certain sense of self. And so that's a useful sense of self to employ on the path, and then when it's served its function, then you can put it aside. So that's the self issue.
Ajahn, I've just been contemplating about five aggregates, and that really stood out yesterday because you were saying that's really the example that the Buddha gives about how we might. You said the Buddha didn't say anything about essence, mm-hmm. but the example is of the five aggregates. Mm-hmm. So with unbinding, mm-hmm. is the unbinding the five aggregates not coming together anymore? Because
but the five aggregates is not there at all in that experience. They're all activities, and in that experience, there's no activities at all.
So the Buddha was still had a form.
You know, he came back to that. I mean, it's like it's having contact with this other dimension. It's like having another room in your mind, and you know, in there are no aggregates at all. And then you come back and you use them as long as you need to, but then when he had his total nirvana, okay, that was it. No more aggregates.
So I know you'll be talking about jhana later, but I've heard that in, for instance, when the body, you feel less of contact with a physical form in jhana, is that like a temporary?
It's a temporary dropping of that aggregate, yeah. Yes. But you will still have feeling, perceptions, fabrication, and consciousness in the formless jhanas.
Yes, yes.
Yes.
Ajahn, just a comment about your direction this morning about the meditation, mm-hmm. The survey of the body. I can very well breathe in through my head or down the spine or down my legs on the inhalation, mm-hmm. but the exhalation, I lose it. And so it's almost like a dual focus. Mm-hmm. Then I am more conscious of the breath in the nose or the chest. Mm-hmm. So it's really a dual focus, it seems to me, for me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, when you're breathing out, try to stay with that part of the body and just ask, what do I feel in that part of the body when I breathe out? And you may not feel any sensation at all and no sensation of movement. That's perfectly fine. But don't move back and forth.
No,
just stay. If you're focusing on the back and the in-breath, stay with the back and the out-breath. Whatever you feel there, that's a kind of breath. Because there are many levels of breathing. There's the breath energy in the body. There's a still energy. And then there's a sort of a movement through the body energy, which you feel more pronounced in some parts of the body than others. And again, differently on the in-breath, differently on the out. And then there's the actual sensation of the air at the nose. And for the mind to really get down solidly still, you'll eventually want to get to that sense of a very still energy. It's kind of like the what I think of as on TV screen when you hit a channel where there's no channel, there's no, and it's just kind of nothing in particular. It's not going anywhere in particular, but it's there. There's still kind of a sense of energy, but it's not moving. And you can contact that. Then the mind can go into much deeper concentration because you don't have to worry about in or out at that point. It's just still.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. We've got five more minutes. Any last questions? Yes.
During the meditation, I find it difficult to follow the breathing when there's pain in the body, mm-hmm. and just one particular part of the body. Mm-hmm. And it comes up quite regularly through the meditations that I have. Mm-hmm. And I just wondered if you have any instruction that I can work with myself to work with that during the meditation.
Okay, first, focus on other parts of the body that you can make comfortable. So that becomes kind of your foundation from which you then eventually will start working on the pain. And the first thing when you're working on the pain from that sense of having a safe sort of beachhead in your body is, can I think of the energy from the comfortable part penetrating through and going through the uncomfortable part? And that'll help kind of loose up the tension you may have built up around that painful part. And then the next one, then you start going into actually analyzing, what is this sensation of pain? How is it related to my perceptions around it? And you can, one, question the perceptions and then try to replace them with other perceptions. The first question you might ask is the pain the same thing as that part of the body, or are they just kind of two different levels of frequency in the same spot? The image that I think of when I'm thinking about this is, you know, we're sitting here in this room, we've got different radio stations coming through the air, and the question is, which one are you going to tune into? They're in the same spot, but you're tuning into a different frequency. So with the body, you can think of, okay, there's earth, water, wind, fire. But those are not pain. The pain is something else. Can you see that distinction? And the simple fact that you're asking this question and you're sort of probing into it puts you in a different relationship to the pain. You're not just sitting there on the receiving end, but you're actually going down and kind of tracking it down. And what you begin to see is that the pain is a lot less solid than you thought it was. And so when you see that it's just got individual moments of pain, then the next question you can ask is, are they coming at me or are they going away? Here the image might be, you're sitting in, you remember those old station wagons with the seat that faced in the back?
I don't remember that. Okay.
Gosh, I guess it dates me, I don't know. But like in a train, you sometimes the train that the seat faces back, right? Okay, you're sitting and watching stuff and going past on the window, and it's going past and going away. As soon as the eyes comes in your field of vision, it's going away. It's not coming at you. And if you can perceive the pain as going away, going away, going away, going, that changes your relationship to it. And there are other questions you can ask around the perception around the pain, but this is the issue, is your perception. And then you begin to see, if you can relate to the pain with using different perceptions, then your relationship becomes different to it, and you're not on the suffering end. So partly it has to do with the fact that you're changing perceptions, and partly it has to do with the fact that you're not just sitting there receiving the pain. When you're kind of probing around into it, you're less of a sitting target. Okay, so that should help. Mm-hmm. Yes. Back there.
I had a question about the meditation as well. It seems like at the beginning, first of all, I'd never experienced that type of meditation before, so it was very new to me. Mm-hmm. It seems that at first, when you're focusing on different parts of the body, the navel, solar plexus, etc., up to the base of the throat, you're breathing in and out, but you're focusing on establishing a form of breath that's comfortable. Mm-hmm. And then when you move into the head and the back of the neck and so on, it seems like the technique changes quite a bit, that you're breathing in and out, but the focus isn't comfort anymore, unless I've misunderstood.
Well, it should be, you try to breathe in a way that is comfortable there as well.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah. Thanks. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, John Lee discovered this method after a trip to India. First, the question was, he saw all these yogis, you know, lying on beds of nails and standing on one foot under the sun. And the question was, you know, how do they do that? And his way of answering the question was not to go up and ask them, because one, he couldn't speak their language. And two, he had his meditative powers. So he got into meditation and asked, and the answer that came back was, they're playing with the breath energy in the body, the prana. And so he tried that himself and discovered that it was very helpful in his meditation. So he came back, wrote down what is now method one in his book, Keeping the Breath in Mind. And then a couple years later, he was going to spend the rains retreat in a forest up in Chiang Mai, and the place he was going required walking through the forest 3 days just to get there. Soon after he arrived, he had a heart attack. So he was, you know, several days away from a doctor in a place where he couldn't leave. and he was going to have to walk out at the end of the rains retreat. And so what was he going to do? Well, he started using the breath again. In this case, he tended to work more with the energies in the body and discover that he could actually put himself back together again using the breath energies. And so when he came back, he wrote down method two, and that was a method they taught ever since. And so it does have, and the emphasis really is on establishing a sense of comfort in the body by the way you breathe and using the energies to provide a better place for the mind to stay.
So are we doing more of the method one type?
No, we're doing more of method two.
Okay.
Method one was more focused on the head. Method two was more focused on the body.
Huh. Thank you.
Okay, it's time to break for lunch. So we'll be back here at 1:15.